Tracy there, please?
This is.
Hey, Tracy, this is Lee Aaron calling you. How are you?
Hello. It is such a pleasure to talk with you. I've been a huge, huge admirer of yours since the 80s. I own all your records on vinyl.
Oh, really? Well, that's really flattering to hear. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I have to tell you, though, my friend and I have the most unfortunate luck when it comes to getting the chance to see you perform live. I think there were two times we had tickets and the show ended up canceled after we got there. And this was back, you know, a long time ago. And it seems like every other time there was something that went wrong. And, you know, we got to the point where, like, we're never going to see her. We now refer to it as the Lee Aaron effect when things go wrong. But please don't take that personally.
Really? So where are you located then?
I'm in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, really? So I'm trying to think of when I was scheduled to play down there and it got canceled.
Oh, interesting. It probably had to be mid-90s or early 90s. A little club near the airport. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's a bummer. Well, you never know. I might make it to, I think there's a couple places. Is Niagara Falls far from you? Or?
No, not at all. It's about 20 minutes. So.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe at some point I'll make it out to the Niagara region. There just aren't as many places to play anymore, period, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I know.
That's a problem.
well, then it's really cool that I get to talk to you finally.
Yeah. So, after 11 years on a hiatus, so to speak, you're back. Why did you choose now?
Well, I always knew I would make another rock record. It was just a matter of when. You know, and there were reasons. I mean, I've taken some interesting diversions throughout the course of my career. A lot of more diehard rock fans maybe don't really understand those choices, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, right now the reason I've come back and I've made another rock record is I took a hiatus to, I have my children. Mm-hmm. I have my daughter in 2004 and my son in 2006. So I've been busy putting all my creative energy into parenting in the last 11 years. And if you've got kids, I'm sure I don't know if you do, but you'd understand. It takes an incredible amount of energy. It's crazy. When I first had my daughter, I had this crazy idea that she would just neatly slot right into my hectic rock and roll life, and that I would just continue on. I'd, you know, just bring a car seat and take her along, and then, you know, hello.
Right.
Giant wake-up call. And you realize you just have to make all these incredible adjustments to for your child. So that's basically what happened. And, you know, previous to that, I made, you know, took some interesting artistic diversions. I experimented with jazz music, and I even actually was cast in an opera out in Vancouver and did a stint for a little while in a Baroque opera, which was interesting. And but, you know, I think all of those things have made me a better, more well-rounded performer and entertainer and songwriter and singer. So, yeah.
Well, you bring up the jazz record, and you know, for those of our listeners that don't know, your first album, you collaborated with Rick Emmett from Triumph. He's an accomplished guitar player, a fellow Canadian, and a very personal favorite of mine, as a lot of people know on our site. But, you know, he also did the crossover into the jazz arena. Have you kept in touch with him? Would it be something that you might entertain of collaborating with him in the future on a jazz or a rock record?
Oh, I would certainly entertain collaborating with him at any point. I think he's a really gifted guitarist and singer and writer. It's funny because you're not the first person who's brought that up to me. So it's not something that has been in the forefront of my mind to pursue, but certainly if it came up, it would be something I would definitely consider doing, because I really have a lot of respect for his talent, for sure.
That would be fantastic. You know, I know, too, there's some people that have kind of made a reappearance on the scene. You're not the only one. Lita Ford being one. She's recently, you know, she came off of a pretty long absence from the scene, and she recently put out a book. And was she an influence on you at an early age?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, because I had recently told someone else this story that when I was, probably 14 or 15 years old, my father and mother both worked at a college in Toronto, the Toronto area, named Humber. I don't know if you know Humber College. And at one point, their radio station there was changing formats. I think they were making the big switch over from vinyl to the short-lived duration of 8-track, I think. How long did 8-track last? About a year? Something like that. And they just decided they were going to get rid of their entire vinyl library. So one day my dad arrived home with this trunk full of albums. And up until that point, believe me, my exposure to pop culture had been extremely limited. I had a little transistor radio, which was my sort of lifeline to reality. And then my mom and dad had, you know, I think like a couple of Roger Whittaker and Anne Marie albums. That was about it. So when he arrived with this trunk of vinyl, I just started going through it. And in that pile of vinyl, I found, you know, Fleetwood Mac Rumors, Elton John, Yellow Brick Road, Led Zeppelin, multiple Led Zeppelin albums, among others, Heart, Dreamboat Annie, which was huge. But in that pile were a couple of Runaways albums. And, I mean, I had never, ever heard girls play rock the way these girls played rock. And the fact that they were just a few years older than I was sort of made it extremely, you know, I was able to make some serious connections there. Like, wow, you know, these girls are just a few years older than I am. They're picking up instruments. They're writing songs. So in a sort of indirect way, I think, yeah, Lita Ford was an influence on me because of those Runaways records.
I think a lot of people might consider you, you know, the Canadian response to her in some ways. But, you know, in the book, she does talk about, you know, the challenges of being a woman in a male-dominated industry and the chauvinistic behaviors that she had to deal with, even from peers, you know, and the people she, you know, toured with and stuff. And how much of that kind of stuff did you experience or run into while you were touring and recording?
Well, yeah, I mean, these days I think it's a lot more common for a woman to be able to pick up an instrument and play an aggressive style of music and be taken seriously. But you got to remember the 80s was rife with sexist attitudes, especially from, I wouldn't say just the music industry, but, you know, it was rife everywhere in pop culture, but especially the advent of Much Music and MTV around that time. You know, there was all of a sudden this new visual medium for people to be able to translate their musical ideas visually. And so one thing that you commonly saw was women being objectified in male rock videos. And because of those strong visual images, I think that that definitely flowed over into real life. So, yeah, there was, I think, just a general attitude that, you know, if you looked good, if you were attractive, there was almost, you were almost knocked down a level, like that you were all of a instantly not taken as seriously as either a player or a writer. So there was that element to it, but there was also this element of, what am I trying to say? If you were a woman, you would also get a lot of attention because you were an anomaly in that genre of music. There were very, very few women doing it. So there was all of a sudden a lot of attention paid to you as well. So there, it was sort of, you know, it was kind of a curse and a blessing. If you were a woman, it was, and you were half decent at your craft, it was easy to get noticed, but it was also easy to get dismissed and to be treated like you were a novelty.
Well, I think, you know, people like yourself and Lita and others, you know, they have stood the test of time, and, you know, people had would soon realize it was not just style over substance. You definitely had a gift and a talent, like you said, and something to offer just besides a pretty face. And
Well, you'd like to think so.
And you're still here, and I think that's great. So let's talk about the new record, Fire and Gasoline. Is all of the material new, or did you have some stuff hanging around in your archives, or maybe stuff you worked on over the years that kind of resurfaced?
You know, I have a few things hanging around, but the reality is most of the material on Fire and Gasoline is brand new. There's one song called Bad Boyfriend. I had that sort of kicking around in had played it in my live show for about the last 5 years, and mm-hmm. it always went over great, so mm-hmm. I did put that on the album. Although we did take it into pre-production and do some work on it, and there were some, you know, arrangement revisions and things like that. The majority of the material is brand new.
Okay.
It's funny because you sort of think you might pull all this material forward that you'd been archiving over that amount of time, but when it came time to write a record, I was sort of feeling that what I needed to do was write material that reflected really in the here and the now.
Right. 50 Miles to Memphis is my favorite song. It's a very bluesy tune. When I first heard it, I'm thinking, is this a continuation of Texas Outlaw by chance? but give us the inspiration behind that song.
It is kind of a continuation of the theme. Throughout my career, I have done songs that have had sort of that blues, southern rock kind of vibe to it. Mm-hmm. So there's Texas Outlaw, but there's a song on my Beautiful Things album from 2004 called Handcuffed to a Fence in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And is a tune we play live that goes over really, really well. So I was actually thinking that 50 Miles was a bit of a companion song to mm-hmm. those two songs.
Wow, cool.
So what was the inspiration? You know, that song was just it came to me on an airplane when, you know, we were flying into Calgary and Edmonton. It's two towns up in Canada mm-hmm. that I play quite frequently, and they are cowboy towns for sure. And so the inspiration for that song was, you know, what if you were, had been pushed to your absolute most violent, most worst behavior by the behavior of a spouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing is worse than feeling like you've been rejected or left, but what if you were left, you know, if your spouse left you not for another woman, but for, say, another man, then the feelings that you had around that would be even more complex. So.
Yeah.
What would that look like?
Hmm.
And how would I put that into a blues rock song? So that was sort of...
That's an interesting take, yeah. For sure. your songs are very autobiographical in nature in a lot of cases, and with this record you deliver some serious emotional messages and concepts, especially on Find the Love and Heart Fix. Want to comment a little bit on those two songs or any others that you...
Well, one might assume they're autobiographical, and perhaps a lot of, you know, what I find with the songwriting process is that sometimes when I'm struck with inspiration, like, I always feel that the best songs kind of write themselves.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the songs on the album were songs that came together very, very quickly for me,
mm-hmm.
and so their inspirations might have been autobiographical, but by the time the songs go through the whole process of, you know, the lyrics being written and revised and the music being fine-tuned, quite often I don't really know exactly what they're about until they're completely finished and
mm-hmm.
I have a chance to listen back.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes those meanings take on new meanings, if that makes any sense.
No,
so
it does, for sure.
The inspirations initially might have come from an autobiographical place, but like, for instance, the song Find the Love. It was originally inspired by when I found out a friend of mine was very, very ill.
Mm-hmm.
She's since passed away.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've also had some circumstances over in the last couple of years of my life where I've lost more than that friend. My mother, for instance, is quite ill right now as well. And so that song started out... as the spark of inspiration was a friend of mine who became quite ill.
Mm-hmm.
But when the song was finished, I realized this is a song for anybody who's lost anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And our lives at this stage of the game have all probably been touched by loss and death. And
yes, so, unfortunately.
You know, I'd like to think that songs like that, or songs that can mean different things to different people,
mm-hmm.
that people can listen to them and have, you know, they can put their own personalized stamp on them when they're hearing them, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah.
So, and that really for me is the goal when I'm writing in general, I think, is for people to be able to interpret something slightly different and slightly apply something personal that, you know, works for their own lives to the songs.
Mm-hmm. I think what you brought up before, too, about the video era, you know, I think that really kind of, as great as it was to launch a lot of careers, it did take away that the personal element for the listener, because now they became a viewer as well. And so you were kind of led in a direction with the video in your brain instead of being left to use your own imagination to interpret the song the way that you wanted. But
no, I see what you mean. Yeah, for sure.
So let's talk about the studio that you chose a little bit to record the new record, Little Farm Studio, which was formerly Little Mountain Studio in Vancouver. How much does the aura of the studio affect the outcome and in the creative process?
It's interesting that you asked that. I personally think that the vibe of a studio can have a pretty dramatic effect on the outcome. It's just walking in there and seeing all those gold and platinum albums on the walls, and like there's such rich history there, and just the rooms themselves, like, I mean, there was, you know, the big space for recording drums, and how do I explain it? It would have been, I think that the outcome and the entire vibe of that album would have been completely different if we'd gone into someone's small little project studio, mm-hmm. put it that way. And I mean, there's plenty of those around that exist now, and plenty of those that do high quality sounding things. I mean, with the advent of digital technology and Pro Tools, and mm-hmm. you can produce pretty much any, you can, you know, make a record in your office, for goodness sakes, these days, right?
Mm-hmm.
But largely, those types of records that are made in those small project studios are piecemealed together that mm-hmm. way, because you don't have the big room where you can actually put the entire band together in the same environment and mic them all up and have them play live off the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was really my goal with this album, is I wanted it to be a real band.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we, I think, really effectively accomplished in the end,
mm-hmm.
was it had the vibe of a real band playing in real time and, you know, live off the floor. And so I'm pretty pleased about that outcome.
That's great. So do you feel that the technology has changed the industry for the good or the bad, or kind of both? I mean, if you compare the way that the things are done nowadays as compared to, you know, 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, I mean, you don't even have to be in the same country to collaborate with somebody and make a record, you know?
You're absolutely right. So, you know, at the risk of sounding like a grumpy old fart, I'd say, you know, I think the state of pop music is pretty sad these days.
Yeah.
I think that people, the reason that you had, like, say, for instance, the tremendous success of an artist like Adele, because people were like, wow, someone's actually really, really singing without, like, massive pitch correction. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think people are absolutely hungry for things that sound human.
Mm-hmm.
And then, with, like I said, the advent of digital technology, you don't even have to know how to play your instrument
mm-hmm.
anymore. You
mm-hmm.
just had, you, all you need to know how to do is play three chords and program a loop. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So much music these days is constructed that way. So what you have is, you don't have a new generation of people that really, really know how to play their instruments and really, really know how to write songs and really, really know their craft.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said for the 10,000 hours, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you've read any Malcolm Gladwell. But, you know, so what we do is we have a generation of people that know how to use touch screens
mm-hmm.
and program
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's changing the heart, you know, the way that music is constructed.
Yeah.
And music is played and, well, or not played, and music is put together. I mean, I'm sure you've seen things floating around on Facebook where, you know, they've compared, you know, here's a a Joni Mitchell tune or compared to a Beyonce tune where, you know, and the lyrics are so dense on the Joni Mitchell and have such depth of meaning and interpretation and, you know, not to criticize Beyonce. I mean, I think she's a wonderful singer, but, and here there's, you know, there's one writer on the Joni Mitchell tune, there's seven or eight writers on the Beyonce song, and, you know, the deepest lyric is, you know, ooh, shake your booty or whatever it is. You know, I'm not a big, I don't know a lot of Beyonce songs, but, you know, you know, a couple of lines that get repeated over and over again that mean absolutely nothing.
Right. No, I think the word depth is a great term to use because, like you said, there's nothing that's going to replace a whole band being in a room and feeding off each other's energy and ideas and the laughs and the, you know, like you said, a human element or a depth to it is, it definitely crosses over into the final product, I think, too. I agree with you 100%. So, your daughter appears in the Tomboy video. Does she want to pursue a career in music or entertainment?
You know what? She actually loves musical theater, and she goes to a fine arts school, and so she is, I think that, in an ideal world, I think she'd love to, you know, be the star in Wicked. You know, I've taken her to quite a few productions, and she asks me a lot of questions around me. So what does it take to be, you know, be in a musical production like that, Mom, as opposed to this musical theater company that I'm in? And, you know, so I, you know, I'm pretty honest with her about, you know, what the music industry looks like and how competitive it is. And so I think that, like, both of our children are musical, musically inclined, and are very, very creative. You know, she also loves dogs, so she might end up being a vet. Okay. You know, I don't really know at this point. She's only 11 years old.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, it's, we have multiple instruments around our home. We have a couple pianos. I've got, I don't know, about seven guitars downstairs. My husband has about 16 drum kits.
Wow.
You know, so there's instruments all over our house. If they want to learn to be a player, they can at any point in time. We've not forced our children to take musical lessons of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why, is only because I meet families where, you know, they've got a 5 or a 7-year-old and they're on their third year of piano, and the child hates practicing because I just don't think young children have the discipline to want to put the time into it. They should be out. To me, I think they should be spending their creative energy outside playing with rocks and sticks and digging dirts in the ground, digging holes in the ground. I mean, you know what I mean? Doing and, you know, doing things like that. And if they are passionate and want to play an instrument, believe me, they're going to let me know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can become a great musician and not start playing till you're 15.
Yeah.
But, you know, I and right now when they sit down, you know, Angela's figured out that she can make chords on the piano and that she picks things out by ear.
Mm-hmm.
I want her to sit down and play, you know, experiment with an instrument because she, there's joy in it for her,
right,
not because she's forced to do it.
Yeah.
And so, whatever our kids decide to do, you know, we're going to support them 100%. And
that's fantastic.
I do feel that they probably will both end up doing something creative.
Yeah.
So,
What are their comments when they look at old pictures of you or even the earlier records and stuff? What is their, you know, like, oh my God, Mom, or, you know.
Well, you know, it's just recently that they've started to make this connection that, wow, you know, our mom was actually at one point a pretty big deal because their, you know, their connection to me is from birth on, and, you know, I'm the lady that makes the craft dinner. Or, you know, I actually can cook some things beyond that, believe it or not. I'm not completely culinarily challenged, but, you know, I'm their parent, right? I'm their mom.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's interesting because I'm quite jet-lagged because I just flew from Mexico a couple of days ago and then from Vancouver to Ontario last night and got in about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
But I'm at my parents' place right now because I've come to visit them for Easter.
Oh.
And as we were getting ready for bed last night, there's a picture of me on the wall when I'm about 18, and my daughter's looking at it. She goes, "Is that you?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And she goes, it looks like you, Mom, but, you know, because I had a perm back then. Like, your hair looks different. I'm like, well, I'm glad I'm still recognizable, honey. Thank you. But, yeah, so...
Well, great.
So it's interesting.
Senior, you need to get some sleep. We'll do a couple of quick questions here and wrap it up here, some fun ones. So what's in your CD player right now, off the top of your head?
Oh, I think the new Courtney Barnett.
Okay.
Are you familiar with her?
I'm not.
Oh, you'd have to look her up. She's from Australia.
Okay.
She's a guitar player, singer. She's like a punk rock Bob Dylan, and she's a female.
Huh. Okay.
And she's from Australia. She's a totally amazing. You have to look her up.
Okay, I will do that. And do you still play the saxophone?
Haven't picked it up in years, I have to be honest. It's just not something that's made it into my new rock.
Yeah. Well,
I was far too intimidated when I was doing jazz to ever pick it up because there's, you know, 8,000 guys in Vancouver who are way, way better than me.
Well, with 16 drum sets in your house, I don't think there'd be even room to have one. So, what is the craziest request or act of adoration you ever received from a fan or admirer?
One of the craziest things, and it's happened multiple times, where I have autographed someone's skin,
uh-huh.
and they've said they're going to go get it tattooed. And I just, in fact, as recently as last August, I was playing a show in Vancouver, and I autographed a girl's, you know, shoulder, and she's like, "Oh, I'm getting this tattooed tomorrow." And I was begging her friend, you know, talk her out of it. You know, it's one thing to, you know, especially, you know, with a younger girl. She was about 18.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, it's, you know, maybe 5 years from now, you won't even like Leanne anymore. I don't want to be like the bad boyfriend tattoo, right? Where they wake up one day and go, "Wow, you know, it was really, you know, Leanne is cool and she's inspiring, and, you know, there's lots of things to take away from that, but I really wish I hadn't gotten that Leanne tattoo on my back when I was 18.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Just because... I think the only tattoos you should ever get are, you know, tattoos of family members you know are never, ever going to be leaving your life.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, people when they're young do silly things, but what was maybe, I mean, when you first realized some success, I'm sure you maybe splurged or did something that you wouldn't do now, but what was maybe one of the first things you splurged on when you got your first taste of success?
Oh, boy. I always wish these were internet questions.
So you could think longer?
Is this a podcast or is this...
It'll be audio.
It'll be an audio.
Yeah.
What was my craziest splurge? I don't know. Probably my custom-made pink leather rocker.
Like,
which is still a trademark. I still have one in my closet.
Okay. And name a guilty pleasure of yours that your fans would be surprised to learn. Like, I don't know, do you get up at 3 in the morning and eat a bowl of Lucky Charms or something? I don't know.
Oh, a guilty pleasure that's my, let me think about that for a sec. Like, again, I said, I hate these on-the-spot questions, especially when I'm sleep-deprived. You know.
Makes for more interesting answers sometimes. There's I interviewed a girl from Canada, a singer, Biff Naked. I don't know if you're aware of her.
Oh, yeah,
but,
I know Biff.
She said her guilty pleasure was Bubblicious gum. And she said she was on tour 1 year, and she said she ate so much or, you know, chewed so much of this gum, by the time she got back, she had like 4 cavities.
That's hysterical. One of my guilty pleasures is sometimes, mm-hmm. secretly, I listen to Madonna when I'm working out.
Okay. All right. That's a good one. That's a good one.
As I'm voguing on the treadmill, I'm thinking of her hard body and how I wish I had one.
Yeah, she had a little meltdown recently, but I have to give her credit. She still looks pretty fantastic for her age. So, oh, boy.
I'm sure she has the finances to have a little bit of
help.
Well.
Yeah, yeah. So, do you have some dates planned to come into upstate New York or in the States in general for the summer? I'm sure you have some things on the calendar as far as festivals and things.
Well, my calendar is just starting to fill up for the summer. Usually, what happens is this in the spring is when I start booking festival dates and shows. And I know that at this point in time, the plan, I am going to be getting to the Ontario region around the end of June because I have a couple of festivals booked there.
Okay.
But you know what? You've got it on my, very present in my mind now, so I'm going to get on the phone to my agent in the next couple of days and say, hey, what about a date in the Niagara area?
That would be great.
It has been forever since I played down there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's probably just due to the fact that it's not as conducive to... Yeah. You know, if you're bringing a band out from Vancouver, I need a proper anchor date to be able to fly my entire band out. But but tagging on a date in the Niagara area might certainly be a possibility. So,
there are some cool venues now.
What would you recommend?
In downtown Buffalo. Oh, boy, there's the Trelf that's been there for forever. That's right in the city. There's the Town Ballroom. There's the Waiting Room. Rapids Theater in Niagara Falls. There's been a couple of shows there recently that were packed, and a lot of bands go there. So there's a few that I can recommend. Definitely look into that because I know there's a lot of people that I know that still know your name when I bring it up, and I think it would be great to have you come here and put a show on for us. So. But it was my honor to talk to you today, Lee. Thank you so much. I wish you continued success. And for God's sake, go kick some ass out there. The world needs you.
Aw, that's amazing. Thank you, Tracy. Yeah, it was great talking to you, too.
Okay, have a wonderful holiday. And, I hope to see you out there.
Yeah, have a great Easter.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
all right,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, do what you say, say what you mean.